Chapter 12. He stood in the long gallery and faced into the light. The tall white curtains billowed softly around him, quiet in the warm breeze. His long black hair was lifted only slightly by the gentle wind. His hands were clasped behind his back. He looked pensive. The silent, lightly clouded skies over the mountains, beyond the fortress and the city, threw a blank, pervasive light across his face, and standing there like that, in plain dark clothes, he looked somehow insubstantial, like some statue, or a dead man propped against the battlements to fool the foe. Somebody spoke his name.
Zakalwe, Sheradinin?
What?
He came to. He looked into the face of an old man who looked vaguely familiar.
Beshai?
He heard himself say.
Of course.
The old man was Soldran Beshai.
Older looking than he remembered.
He looked around, listening. He heard a hum and saw a small, bare cabin.
Sea ship? Spaceship?
Awesome Emaninish, a voice from his memory told him. Spaceship. Clipper. Bound for... somewhere near Impren, whatever and wherever that was. Impren habitats. He had to get Soldran Beshai to the Impren habitats. Then he remembered the little doctor and his wonderful field machine with the cutting blue disc. Digging deeper in a way that would not have been possible without the culture's training and subtle changes, he found the little running loop of memory that took over from what his brain had already stored. The room with the fiber optics, blowing a kiss because it was just what he'd wanted. The explosion, sailing across the bar into the lounge, crashing, hitting his head. The rest was very vague. Distant screams, and being picked up and carried. Nothing sensible from the voices he'd registered while he'd been unconscious. He lay for a moment, listening to what his body was telling him. No concussion. Slight damage to his right kidney. Lots of bruises. Abrasions on both knees. Cuts on right hand. Nose still mending. He raised himself up, looked again at the cabin. Bare metal walls. Two bunks. One small stool Beshai was sitting on.
"This the brig?"
Beshai nodded.
"Yes, the prison."
He lay back. He noticed he was wearing a disposable crew jumpsuit. The terminal bead had gone from his ear, and the lobe was raw and sore enough to make him suspect the transceiver hadn't relinquished its grip there without a struggle.
"You two, or just me?" he asked.
"Just you."
"What about the ship?"
"I believe we're heading for the nearest stellar system, on the vessel's backup drive."
"What's the nearest system?"
"Well, the one inhabited planet is called Mersey. There's a war going on in part of it. One of those brush-fire conflicts you mentioned. Apparently the ship may not be allowed to land."
"Land?"
He grunted, feeling the back of his head. "Largish bruise. This ship can't land. It's not built for in-atmosphere stuff."
"Oh," Soldran said.
"Well, perhaps they meant we wouldn't be able to go down to the surface."
Must have some sort of orbiter. A space station. Yes?"
Beshai shrugged.
"I suppose so."
He looked round the cabin, making it obvious he was looking for something.
"What do they know about you?"
He gestured round the cabin with his eyes. Beshai smiled.
"They know who I am. I've talked to the captain, Sheradinin.
They did receive an order from the shipping company to turn back, though they didn't know why. Now they know why.
The captain had the choice of waiting for humanist naval units to pick us up, or heading for Mersey, and he chose the latter, despite some pressure, I believe, from governance, via the shipping company. Apparently he insisted that the distress channel was used when he informed the shipping line of both what had happened to the ship and who I was.
So, now everybody knows.
Yes, I imagine by now the whole cluster knows exactly who both of us are. But the point is that I think the captain might not be entirely unsympathetic to our cause.
Yeah. Or what happens when we get to Mersey?
"Looks like we get rid of you, Mr. Zakalwe," said a voice from a speaker overhead. He looked at Beshai.
"I hope you heard that too."
"I believe that might be the captain," Beshai said.
"It is," said the man's voice. "And we just got informed that we part company before we even get to Mersey station."
The man sounded peeved.
"Really, Captain?"
"Yes, really, Mr. Zakalwe. I have just received a military communication from the Balzite Hegemonarchy of Mersey. They want to uplift you and Mr. Beshai before we connect with the station. As they are threatening to attack us if we don't comply, I intend to do as they ask. Technically under protest, but frankly it will be a relief to be rid of you. I may add that the vessel they intend to take you off with must be a couple of centuries old, and was not thought to be spaceworthy until now. If it survives to make the rendezvous in a couple of hours, you ought to have an eventful journey through Mersey's atmosphere. Mr. Beshai, I believe if you reasoned with the Balzite people, they might let you continue with us to Mersey station. Whatever you decide, sir, let me wish you a safe trip."
Beshai sat back on the small stool.
"Balzite," he said, nodding thoughtfully.
"I wonder why they want us."
"They want you, Soldrin," he said, swinging his feet off the bed. He looked uncertain.
"They on the good guy's side?"
"There's so damned many of these little wars."
"Well, in theory they are," Beshai said. "I think they believe planets and machines can have souls."
"Yeah, I thought they were," he said, getting slowly to his feet. He flexed his arms, moved his shoulders. "If this Mersey station is neutral territory, you'd be better going there, though I'd guess this Balzite gang want you, not me."
He rubbed the back of his head again, trying to remember what the situation was on Mersey. Mersey was just the sort of place that could start a full-scale war.
There was, in effect, a consolidationist-humanist war taking place between relatively archaic military forces on Mersey. Balzite was on the consolidationist side, even though the High Command was some sort of priesthood. Why they wanted Beshai, he wasn't sure, though he vaguely recalled that the priests were into hero worship in a fairly serious way. Though, having heard that Beshai was nearby, maybe they just wanted to hold him to ransom. 6 hours later, they rendezvoused with the ancient Balzite spacecraft.
"They want me?" he said.
They stood by the airlock. Him, Beshai, the awesome Emanenish's captain, and 4 suited figures with guns. The suited men wore visored helmets, their pale brown faces visible inside, foreheads marked with a blue circle. The circles actually seemed to glow, he thought, and he wondered if they were there because of some generous religious principle to help snipers.
"Yes, Mr. Zakalwe," the captain said. He was a rotund little man with a shaved head. He smiled.
"They want you, not Mr. Beshai."
He looked at the 4 armed men.
"What are they up to?" he asked Beshai.
"I have no idea," Beshai admitted.
He waved his hands out, appealing to the 4 men.
"Why do you want me?"
"Please come with us, sir," one of the suited men said, via a suit speaker in what was obviously not his first language. "Please," he said.
"You mean I have a choice?"
The man looked uncomfortable in his suit. He talked for a while without any noise coming from the speaker, then said,
"Sir Zakalwe, is very important you come. You must. Is very important."
He shook his head.
"I must," he repeated seemingly to himself. He turned to the captain.
"Captain, sir, could I have my earring back, please?"
"No,"
the captain said, with a beatific grin. "Now, get off my ship." The craft was cramped and very low-tech, and the air was warm and smelled of electrics. They gave him an old suit to put on, and he was shown to a couch and belted in. It was a bad sign when they made you put a suit on inside a ship. The troopers who'd taken him from the clipper sat behind him. The three-man crew, also suited up, seemed suspiciously busy, and he had the disquieting impression that the manual controls in front of them were not just for emergencies. The craft re-entered the atmosphere spectacularly. Buffeted, creaking, surrounded by gas glowing bright, seen through, he realized with a gut-wrenching shock, windows. Crystal or glass, not screens. And with a gradually increasing howl. The air got even warmer. Flashing lights, hurried chatter between the crew, and some hurried movements, and more excited talk, did not make him feel any happier. The glow disappeared, and the sky turned from violet to blue. The buffeting returned. They swept into the night and plunged into cloud. The flashing lights all over the control panels looked even more worrying in darkness. It was a rolling landing on some sort of runway in a thunderstorm. The four troopers who'd boarded the awesome Imanenish cheered weakly from behind him as the landing gear, wheels, he supposed, touched down. The craft trundled on for a worryingly long time, slewing twice. When they finally rolled to a stop, the three crewmen all sat back slumped in their seats, arms dangling over the edges, silent and staring out into the rain-filled night. He undid the belts, took off the helmet. The troopers opened the interior airlock. When they opened the outer door, it was to reveal rain and lights and trucks and tanks and some low buildings in the background and a couple of hundred people, some in military uniforms, some in long robes, rain-slicked, some trying to hold umbrellas over others. All seemed to have the circular marks on their foreheads. A group of a dozen or so, all old, robed, white-haired, faces spattered with rain, walked to the bottom of the steps that led from the craft to the ground. "Please, sir," one of the troopers held out a hand to indicate they should descend. The white-haired men in the robes gathered in an arrowhead formation at the foot of the steps. He stepped out, stood on the little platform before the stairs. The rain battered into one side of his head. A great shout went up, and the dozen old men at the foot of the steps each bowed their head and went down on one knee into the puddles on the dark and wind-whipped runway. A blast of blue light ripped the blackness beyond the low buildings, its flickering brilliance momentarily illuminating hills and mountains in the distance. The assembled people started to chant. It took them a few moments to work out what it was, then realized they were yelling, "Zakalwe, Zakalwe." "Uh-oh," he said to himself. Thunder bellowed in the hills.
"Yeah, could you just run that past me again?"
"Messiah.
I really wish you wouldn't use that word."
"Oh. Oh, well, Sir Zakalwe, what do you wish?"
How about..." He gestured with his hands.
Mister?
Sir Zakalwi, sir, you are preordained. You have been beseen.
The high priest, sitting across the railway carriage, clenched his hands.
Beseen? Indeed, you are our salvation, our divine recompense. You have been sent.
Sent? He repeated, still trying to come to terms with what had happened to him.
They'd switched the floodlights off shortly after he'd set foot on the ground.
The priests enveloped him, took him, many arms round his shoulders, from the concrete apron to an armoured truck. The lights went out on the runway, and they were left with the slit light from the truck and tank lights. Cones made fans by blinkers clipped over the lights. He was bustled away down the track to a railway station, where they transferred to a shuttered carriage that clattered into the night.
There were no windows.
Why, yes. Our faith has a tradition of finding outside influences, because they are always greater.
The high priest, Naparia, he'd said his name was, made a bowing motion.
And what can be greater than the man who was Com Mil?
Com Mil. He had to dredge his memory for that one.
Com Mil. That was what he had been, according to the cluster's media. Director of military operations when he and Soldran Beshai had been involved in the whole crazy dance the last time.
Beshai had been Com Pol, in charge of politics.
Aha, these fine divisions.
Com Mil.
He nodded, not really much the wiser.
And you think I can help you?
Sir Zakalwi, the high priest said, shifting down from his seat to kneel on the floor again, you are what we believe in.
He sat back in the upholstered cushions.
May I ask why?
Sir, your deeds are legend, forever since the last unpleasantness. Our guider, before he died, prophesied that our salvation would come from beyond the skies, and your name was one of those mentioned. So coming to us in our hour of need, you must be our salvation.
I see, he said, seeing nothing.
Well, we'll see what we can do.
Messiah.
The train drew up in a station somewhere. They were escorted from it to an elevator, then to a suite of rooms that he was told looked out over the city beneath, but it was all in blackout. The internal screens were closed. The rooms themselves were quite opulent. He inspected them.
Yes. Very nice. Thank you.
And here are your boys, the high priest said, sweeping aside a curtain in the bedroom to reveal a languorously displayed half-dozen or so young men lying on a very large bed.
Well, thank you, he said, nodding to the high priest.
He smiled at the boys, who all smiled back. He lay awake in the ceremonial bed in the palace, hands behind his neck. After a while, in the darkness, there was a distinct pop, and in a disappearing blue sphere of light there was a tiny machine about the size of a human thumb.
Zakalwi?
Aisma?
Listen.
No, you listen.
I would really like to know what the fuck is going on here.
Zakalwi, Smar said, through the scout missile.
It's complicated, but I'm in here with a gang of homosexual priests who think I'm going to solve all their military problems.
Shradinin, Smar said, in her winning voice.
These people have successfully incorporated a belief in your martial prowess into their religion. How can you deny them?
Believe me, it would be easy. Like it or not, Shradinin, you've become a legend to these people. They think you can do things.
So what am I supposed to do?
Guide them. Be their general. That's what they expect me to be, I think. But what should I really do?
Just that, Smar's voice said. Lead them.
Meanwhile, Beshai is in the station, Mersey station. That counts as neutral territory for now, and he's making the right noises. Don't you see, Zakalwi? Smar's voice sounded tense, exultant.
We've got them.
Beshai is doing just what we wanted, and all you have to do is...
What?
Just be yourself. Operate for these guys.
He shook his head.
Smar, spell it out for me. What am I supposed to do?
He heard Smar sigh.
Win their war, Zakalwi. We're putting our weight behind the forces you're working with. Maybe if they can win this, and Beshai gets behind the winning side here, we can, perhaps, swing the cluster.
He heard her take another deep breath.
Zakalwi, we need this. To a degree, our hands are tied, but we need you to make the whole thing settle out. Win their war for them, and we might just be able to get it all together.
Seriously?
Fine, seriously, he said to the scout missile, but I've already had a quick look at their maps, and these guys are in deep shit. If they're going to win this war, they're going to need a real miracle.
Just try, Sheradinian. Please.
Do I get any help?
How do you mean?
Intelligence, Smar. If you could keep an eye on what the enemy's... Ah, no, Sheradinian, I'm sorry we can't.
What?
He said loudly, sitting up in the bed. I'm sorry, Zakalwi, really I am, but we've had to agree to that. This is a really delicate deal here, and we're having to keep strictly out of it. This missile shouldn't even be here, and it'll have to leave soon.
So I'm on my own.
I'm sorry, Smar said.
You're sorry, he said, collapsing back dramatically on the bed.
No soldiering, he recalled Smar saying some time ago now.
No fucking soldiering, he muttered to himself as he gathered his hair at the nape of his neck and pulled the little hide band over it.
It was dawn. He patted the ponytail and looked out through thick, distorting glass to the mist-shrouded city, just starting to wake to the dawn-rouged mountain peaks and the blue, glowing skies above. He looked with distaste at the over-ornamented long robes the priests expected him to wear, then reluctantly put them on. The hegemonarchy and its opponents, the Glassine Empire, had been fighting on and off for control of their modestly sized subcontinent for 600 years before the rest of the cluster came calling in its strange floating skyships a century ago. They had been backward even then, compared to the other societies on Mersey, which were decades ahead in technology and, arguably, several centuries ahead morally and politically. Before they'd been contacted, the natives had the crossbow and the muzzle-loading cannon. Now, a century later, they had tanks. Lots of tanks. Tanks and artillery and trucks and a few very inefficient aircraft. Each side also had one prestige system, partially bought from, but mostly just donated, by some of the cluster's more advanced societies. The hegemonarchy had its single sixth or seventh-hand spacecraft. The Empire had a clutch of missiles which were generally reckoned to be inoperable, and probably were politically unusable anyway, because they were supposed to be nuclear-tipped. Public opinion in the cluster could tolerate the technologically enhanced continuation of a pointless war so long as men, women, and children died in relatively small, regular batches. But the thought of a million or so being incinerated at once, nuked in a city, was not to be tolerated. The Empire was winning a conventional war then, being waged across two impoverished countries which left to themselves would probably just be harnessing steam power. Instead, refugee peasants filled the roads. Carts loaded with whole households swayed between hedgerows, while the tanks ploughed the crop fields and the droning planes dropping bombs took care of slum clearance. The hegemonarchy was retreating across the plains and into the mountains as its beleaguered forces fell back before the Empire's motorized cavalry. He went straight to the map room after dressing. A few dozy general staff officers jumped to attention and rubbed sleep from their eyes. The maps didn't look any better in the morning than they had the previous evening, but he stood looking at them for a long time, sizing up the positions of their forces and the Empire's, asking the officers questions and trying to gauge how accurate their intelligence was and what level their own troops' morale was at. The officers seemed to know more about the disposition of their enemy's forces than they did about the feelings of their own men. He nodded to himself, scanned all the maps, then left for breakfast with Naparia and the rest of the priests. He dragged them all back down into the map room afterwards. They would normally have returned to their own apartments for contemplation, and asked even more questions. "And I want a uniform like these guys," he said, pointing at one of the junior regular army officers in the map room. "But Sir Zakalwi," Naparia said, looking worried, "those would demean you." "And these will slow me down," he said, indicating the long, heavy robes he was wearing. "I want to take a look at the front myself." "But, sir, this is the Holy Citadel. All our intelligence comes here. All our people's prayers are directed here." "Naparia," he said, putting his hand on the other man's shoulder, "I know. But I need to see things for myself. I only just got here, remember?" He looked round the unhappy faces of the other high priests. "I'm sure your ways work when circumstances are as they have been in the past," he told them, straight-faced. "But I'm new, and so I have to use new ways to discover what you probably already know." He turned back to Naparia. "I want my own plane. A modified reconnaissance aircraft should do. 2 fighters as an escort." The priests had thought it the height of daring unorthodoxy to venture out to the spaceport, 30 kilometers away, by train and truck. They thought he was mad to want to start flying all over the subcontinent. It was what he did for the next few days, however. There was a lull of sorts in the fighting just at that point, as the hegemonarchy's forces fled and the Empire's consolidated, which made his task a little easier. He wore a plain uniform, without even the half dozen or so medal ribbons that even the most junior officers seemed to warrant just for existing. He spoke to the mostly dull, demoralized and thoroughly hidebound field generals and colonels, to their staff, and to the foot soldiers and tank crews, as well as to the cooks and the supply teams and the orderlies and doctors. Most of the time he needed an interpreter. Only the top brass spoke the cluster's common tongue, but even so he suspected the troops felt closer to somebody who spoke a different language but asked them questions than they did to somebody who shared their language and only ever used it to give orders. He toured every major airfield in the course of that first week, sounding out the Air Force staff for their feelings and opinions. About the only person he tended to ignore on such occasions was the always watchful priest every squadron, regiment, and fort had as its titular head. The first few of these priests he'd encountered had had nothing useful to say, and none of those he saw subsequently ever seemed to have anything interesting to add beyond the ritualized initial greetings. He had decided within the first couple of days that the main problem the priests had was themselves. "Shenastri province," Naparia exclaimed. "But there are a dozen important religious sites there. More. And you propose to surrender without a fight?" "You'll get the temples back once we've won the war, and probably lots of new treasure to put inside them. They're going to fall whether we try to hold there or not, and they'll probably be damaged if not destroyed in the fighting. This way, they'll survive intact, and it stretches their supply lines like crazy. Look, the rains start in.
What? A month?
By the time we are ready to counterattack, they'll have even worse supply problems. The wetlands behind them mean they can't bring stuff that way, and they can't retreat there once we do attack. Nappy, old son, this is beautiful. Believe me. If I was a commander on the other side, and I saw this area being offered, I wouldn't go within a million clicks of it. But the Imperial Army boys are going to have to, because the court won't let them do anything else. But they'll know it's a trap. Terrible for the morale. I don't know. Naparia shook his head, both his hands at his mouth, massaging his lower lip while he looked worriedly at the map. No, you don't know, he thought to himself, watching the man's nervous body language. You lot haven't known anything very useful for generations, chum. It must be done, he said. The withdrawal should start today. He turned to another map. Aircraft. Stop the bombing and strafing of the roads. Give the pilots 2 days' rest. Then raid the oil refineries here. He pointed. A mass raid. Use everything with the range that'll fly.
But if we stop attacking the roads, they'll fill with even more refugees, he told the man.
That'll slow the Imperial Army down more than our planes. I do want some of these bridges taken out. He tapped a couple of river crossings. He looked mystified at Naparia. You guys signed some sort of agreement not to bomb bridges or something?
It has always been felt that destroying bridges would hinder a counterattack, as well as being wasteful, the priest said unhappily.
Well, these three have to go anyway. He tapped the surface of the map. That and the refinery raid should put some sand in their fuel lines, he said, clapping his hands together and rubbing them.
But we believe the Imperial Army has great reserves of fuel, Naparia said, looking very unhappy.
Even if they have, he told the High Priest, commanders will move more cautiously knowing supplies have been interrupted. They're careful guys. But I bet they never did have the supplies you thought.
They probably think you have bigger supplies than you do. And with the advance they've had to fund recently.
Believe me, they may panic a little if the refinery raid comes off the way I hope it will.
Naparia looked downcast, rubbed his chin while he gazed forlornly at the maps.
It all sounds very, he began, very adventurous.
The High Priest invested the word with a degree of loathing and contempt that might have been amusing in other circumstances. Under great protest, the High Priests were persuaded they must give up their precious province and its many important religious sites to the enemy. They agreed to the mass raid on the refinery.
He visited the retreating soldiers and the main airfields that would take part in the refinery raid. Then he took a couple of days travelling the mountain by truck, inspecting the defences. There was a valley with a dam at its head that might also provide an effective trap if the Imperial Army made it that far. He remembered the concrete island, the snivelling girl and the chair. While he was driven along the rough roads between the hill forts, he saw 100 or more aircraft drone overhead, heading out across the still peaceful-looking plains, their wings loaded with bombs. The refinery raid was expensive. Almost a quarter of the planes never came back. But the Imperial Army's advance halted a day later. He had hoped they would keep on coming for a bit. Their supplies hadn't been supplied straight from the refinery, so they could have kept going for a week or so. But they'd done the sensible thing and stopped for the moment. He flew to the spaceport, where the lumbering spaceship, it looked even more dangerous and dilapidated in daylight, was being slowly patched up and repaired in case it was ever wanted again. He talked to the technicians, took a look round the ancient device. The ship had a name, he discovered. The Hegemonarchy Victorious. "It's called Decapitation," he told the priests. "The Imperial Court travels to Willitice Lake at the start of every second season. The High Command comes to brief them. We drop the Victorious in on them the day the General Staff arrive." The priests looked puzzled. "With what, Sir Zakalwe? A commando force? The Victorious is only able to hold..." "No, no," he said. "When I say drop it, I mean we bomb them with it. We put it into space and then bring it back in, down on top of the Lake Palace. It's a good 400 tons. Even travelling at only 10 times the speed of sound, it'll hit like a small nuke going off. We'll get the entire court and the General Staff in one go. We offer peace to the Commoners' Parliament immediately. With any luck at all, we cause immense civil disturbance. Probably the Commoners' Parliament will see this as their chance to grab real power. The army will want to take up the reins itself and may even have to turn round and fight a civil war. Junior aristos filing competing claims should complicate the situation nicely." "But," Naparia said, "this means destroying the Victorious, does it not?" The other priests were shaking their heads. "Well, impacting at 4 or 5 kilometers a second wouldn't leave it totally undented, I suspect." "But Zakalwe!" Naparia roared, doing a reasonable impression of a small nuclear explosion himself. "That's absurd. You can't do it. The Victorious is a symbol of... it's our hope. All the people look at our..." He smiled, letting the priest ramble on for a little while. He was fairly certain the priest looked on the Hegemonarchy Victorious as their escape route if things went badly in the end. He waited until Naparia had almost finished, then said, "I understand. But the craft is on its last legs already, gentlemen. I've talked to the technicians and the pilots. It's a death trap. It was more luck than anything else that it got me here safely." He paused, watching the men with the blue circles on their foreheads look wide-eyed at each other. The muttering increased. He wanted to smile. That had put the fear of God into them. "I'm sorry, but this is the one thing the Victorious is good for." He smiled. "And it could indeed produce victory." He left them to mull over the concepts of high hypersonic dive bombing. No suicide mission required. The craft's computers were perfectly capable of taking it up and bringing it straight down. Symbol trashing. A lot the peasants and factory workers would care about their piece of high-tech bauble getting junked. And decapitation. Probably the most worrying idea of the lot for the high priests. What if the Empire thought of doing it to them? He assured them the Empire would be in no state to retaliate, and when they offered peace, the priests would hint heavily they had used a missile of their own, not the spacecraft, and pretend there were more where that came from. Even though this would not be difficult to disprove, especially if one of the world's more sophisticated societies chose to tell the Empire what had really happened, it would still be worrying for whoever was trying to work out what to do on the other side. Besides, they could always just get out of the city. Meanwhile, he went to visit more army units. The Imperial Army started its advance again, though slower than before. He had drawn his troops back almost to the foothills of the mountains, burning the few unharvested fields and razing the towns behind them. Whenever they abandoned an airfield, they planted bombs under the runways with days-long time delays, and dug plenty of other holes that looked like they might contain bombs. In the foothills, he supervised much of the layout of their defensive lines himself, and kept up his visits to airfields, regional headquarters, and operational units. He kept up, too, the pressure on the high priests at least to consider using the spacecraft for a decapitation strike. He was busy, he realized one day, as he lay down to sleep in an old castle that had become operational HQ for this section of the front. The sky had bloomed with light on the tree-lined horizon, and the air shaken with the sound of a bombardment just after dusk. Busy and, he had to admit, as he put the last reports on the floor under the camp bed, and put the light out and was almost instantly asleep. Happy. 2 weeks, 3 weeks from his arrival. The little news that came in from outside seemed to indicate there was an awful lot of nothing going on. He suspected there was a lot of intense politicking taking place. Beishai's name was mentioned. He was still on the Mersey station in touch with the various parties. No word of the culture, or from it. He wondered if they ever just forgot things. Maybe they'd forget about him, leave him here, struggling forever in the priests and the Empire's insane war. The defences grew. The hegemonarchy's soldiers dug and built, but were mostly not under fire, and the Imperial army gradually lapped against the foothills and paused. He had the Air Force harry the supply lines and the frontline units and pound the nearest airfields. There are far too many troops stationed here around the city. The best troops should be at the front. The attack will come soon, and if we're to counterattack successfully, and it could be very successfully if they're tempted to go for a knockout, they've little left in reserve, then we need those elite squads where they can do some good. There is the problem of civil unrest, Naparia said. He looked old and tired. Keep a few units here, and keep them in the streets, so people don't forget they're here. But damn it, Naparia, most of these guys spend all their time in barracks. They're needed at the front. I have just the place for them. Look. Actually, he wanted to tempt the Imperial Army to go for the knockout, and the city was to be the bait. He sent the crack troops into the mountain passes. The priests looked at how much territory they'd now lost, and tentatively gave the go-ahead for preparing for decapitation. The hegemonarchy victorious would be readied for its final flight, though not used unless the situation appeared genuinely desperate. He promised he would try to win the war conventionally first. The attack came. 40 days after he had arrived on Mersey, the Imperial army crashed into the foothill forests. The priests began to panic. He had the Air Force attack the supply lines the majority of the time, not the front. The defensive lines gradually gave way. Units retreated. Bridges were blown. Gradually, as the foothills led into the mountains, the Imperial army was concentrated, funneled into the valleys. The trick with the dam didn't work this time. The charges placed under it just didn't go off. He had to move fast to shift 2 elite units to cover the pass above that valley. But if we leave the city? The priests looked stunned. Their eyes looked as empty as the painted blue circle on their foreheads. The Imperial army was slowly moving up the valleys, forcing their soldiers back. He kept telling them things would be all right, but things just got worse and worse. There was nothing else for them to do. It all seemed too hopeless, and too late to take things back into their own hands. Last night, with the wind blowing down from the mountains to the city,
The sound of distant artillery had been audible.
"They'll try to take Belzite City if they think they can," he said. "It's a symbol." "Well, fine, but it doesn't actually have much military importance. They'll grab at it. We let just so many through, then we close the passes. Here," he said, tapping the map.
The priests shook their heads.
"Gents, we are not in disarray. We are falling back. But they are in much worse shape than we are, taking far heavier casualties. Each meter is costing them blood. And all the time their supply lines get longer. We must take them to the point where they start to think about pulling back, then present them with the possibility, the seeming possibility, of a knockout blow. But it won't knock us out. It knocks them out."
He looked round them.
"Believe me, it'll work. You may have to leave the citadel for a while, but when you return, I guarantee it will be in triumph." They didn't look convinced, but possibly because they were just too stunned to fight, they let him have his way. It took a few days, while the Imperial army struggled up the valleys, and the Hegemonarchy's forces resisted, retreated, resisted, retreated, but eventually, watching for signs that the Imperial soldiers were tiring, and the tanks and trucks not always moving when they might have wanted to, starved of fuel, he decided that were he on the other side, he'd be thinking about halting the advance. That night, in the pass which led down to the city, most of the Hegemonarchy troops left their positions. In the morning, the battle resumed, and the Hegemonarchy's men suddenly retreated, shortly before they would have been overrun. A puzzled, excited, but still exhausted and worried general in the Imperial High Command watched through field glasses as a distant convoy of trucks crawled away down the pass towards the city, occasionally strafed by Imperial aircraft. Reconnaissance suggested the infidel priests were making preparations to leave their citadel. Spies indicated that their spacecraft was being readied for some special mission. The general radioed the court high command. The order to advance on the city was given the following day. He watched the terminally worried-looking priests leave from the train station under the citadel. In the end, he had to dissuade them from ordering the decapitation attack. "Let me try this first," he told them. They could not understand each other. The priests looked at the territory they had lost and the fraction they had left and thought it was all over for them. He looked at his relatively unscathed divisions, his fresh units, his crack squads, all positioned just where they should be, knives laid against and inside the body of an overextended, worn-out enemy, just ready to cut, and thought it was all over for the Empire. The train pulled out, and, unable to resist, he waved cheerily. The high priests would be better out of the way in one of their great monasteries in the next mountain range. He ran back upstairs to the map room to see how things were going. He waited until a couple of divisions had made it through the pass, then had the units that had held it, and mostly retreated into the forests around the pass, not gone down the pass at all, take it again. The city and the citadel were bombed, though not well. The Hegemonarchy's fighters shot most of the bombers down. The counterattack finally began. He started with the elite troops, then brought in the rest. The Air Force still concentrated on the supply lines for the first couple of days, then switched to the front line. The Imperial Army wavered, line crinkling. It seemed to hesitate like some wash of water, almost but not quite capable of overspilling the damming line of mountains, save in one place, and That trickle was drying, still pushing for the city, leaving the pass, fighting through the forests and fields for the shining goal they still hoped might win the war. Then the line fell back. The soldiers too exhausted, their supplies of ammunition and fuel too sporadic. The passes stayed with the hegemonarchy, and slowly they pushed down from them again, so that it must have seemed to the imperial soldiers that they were forever shooting uphill, and that while advancing had been a heavy, dangerous slog, retreating was only too easy. The retreat became a rout in valley after valley. He insisted on keeping the counterattack going. The priests cabled that more forces ought to be deployed to stop the advance of the two imperial divisions on the capital. He ignored them. There was barely enough left of the two tattered divisions to make one whole one, and they were being gradually eroded further all the time. It was possible they might make it to the city, but after that they would have nowhere to go. He thought it might be satisfying to accept their eventual surrender personally. The rains came on the far side of the mountains, and as the bedraggled imperial forces made their way through the dripping forests, their air force was all too often grounded by bad weather, while the hegemonarchy's planes bombed and strafed them with impunity. People fled to the city. Artillery duels thundered nearby. The remnants of the two divisions that had broken through the mountains fought desperately on towards their goal. On the distant plains on the far side of the mountains, the rest of the imperial army was retreating as fast as it could. The divisions trapped in Shanastri province, unable to retreat through the quagmire behind them, surrendered en masse. The imperial court signalled its desire for peace the day, or what was left of its two divisions, entered Balzac City. They had 12 tanks and 1,000 men, but they left their artillery in the fields bereft of ammunition. The few thousand people left in the city sought refuge in the wide parade grounds of the citadel. He watched them stream in through the gates in the high walls, far in the distance. He'd been going to quit the citadel that day. The priests had been screaming at him to do so for days, and most of the general staff had already left. But now he held the transcript of the message they'd just received from the imperial court. Two hegemonarchy divisions were, anyway, on their way out of the mountains, coming to the aid of the city. He radioed the priests. They decided to accept the truce. Fighting would stop immediately if the imperial army withdrew to the positions it had held before the war. There were a few more radio exchanges. He left the priests and the imperial court to sort it all out. He took off his uniform and, for the first time since he'd arrived, dressed as a civilian. He went to a high tower with some field glasses and watched the tiny specks that were enemy tanks as they rolled down a street far away. The citadel gates were closed. A truce was declared at midday. The weary imperial soldiers outside the citadel gates billeted themselves in the bars and hotels nearby. He stood in the long gallery and faced into the light. The tall white curtains billowed softly around him, quiet in the warm breeze. His long black hair was lifted only slightly by the gentle wind. His hands were clasped behind his back. He looked pensive. The silent, lightly clouded skies over the mountains, beyond the fortress and the city, threw a blank, pervasive light across his face, and standing there like that, in plain, dark clothes, he looked insubstantial, like some statue or a dead man propped against the battlements to fool the foe. Zakalwe? He turned. His eyes widened in surprise. Scafinantiskor, this is an unexpected honour. Smar letting you out alone these days, or is she about too?
He looked the length of the citadel's long gallery.
Good day, Sharadinin, the drone said, floating towards him. Niz Smar is on her way in a module.
And how is Dizzy?
He sat down on a small bench set against the wall, which faced the long line of white-curtained windows.
What's the news?
I believe it is mostly good, Scaffin Antiscor said, floating level with his face. Mr. Beishai is on his way to the Impren habitats, where a summit conference between the cluster's two main tendencies is to be held. It would appear the danger of war is lessening.
Well, isn't this all very wonderful, he said, sitting back with his hands behind his neck. Peace here, peace out there.
He squinted at the drone, his head to one side. And yet, drone, somehow you do not seem to be overflowing with joy and happiness.
You seem, dare I say it, positively somber.
What's the matter?
Batteries low?
The machine was silent for a second or two. Then it said, I believe Ms. Smar's module is about to land. Shall we go to the roof?
He looked puzzled for a moment, then nodded, stood smartly and clapped his hands once, indicating the way forward.
Certainly.
Let's go.
They went to his apartments. He thought Smar seemed rather subdued, too. He'd imagined she'd be bubbling over with excitement because the cluster looked like it wasn't going to go to war after all.
What's the problem, Dizzy? He asked, pouring her a drink. She was pacing up and down in front of the room's shuttered windows.
She took the drink from him, but didn't seem interested in it. She turned to face him, her long, oval face looking...
He wasn't sure.
But there was a cold feeling somewhere in his guts.
You have to leave, Sharadinin, she told him.
Leave?
When?
Now. Tonight. Tomorrow morning at the latest.
He looked confused, then laughed.
Okay. I confess. The Katamites were starting to look attractive, but...
No, Smar said.
I'm serious, Sharadinin.
You have to go.
He shook his head.
I can't.
There's no guarantee the truce will hold.
They might need me.
The truce isn't going to hold, Smar told him, looking away. Not on one side, anyway.
She put a glass down on a shelf.
Eh? He said.
He glanced at the drone, which was looking noncommittal.
Dizier, what are you talking about?
Zakalwi, she said, eyes blinking rapidly. She tried to look at him.
A deal's been done.
You have to leave.
He stared at her.
What's the deal, Dizzy? He said softly.
There was some fairly low-level help being given to the Empire by the Humanist faction, she told him, walking towards one wall, then returning, talking not to him, but to the tile and carpet floor.
They had face invested in what's been happening here.
The whole delicate structure of the deal did rather depend on the Empire triumphing here.
She stopped, glanced at the drone looking away again.
Which is what everybody agreed was going to happen, up until a few days ago.
So, he said slowly, putting aside his own drink, sitting down in a great chair that looked like a throne.
I messed things up by turning the game against the Empire, did I?
Yes, Smar said, swallowing.
Yes, you did. I'm sorry.
And I know it's crazy, but that's the way things are here. The way the people are here.
The humanists are divided at the moment, and there are factions within them that would use any excuse to argue for getting out of the deal, however insignificant that excuse might be. They might just be able to pull the whole thing down. We can't take that risk. The Empire has to win. He sat, looking at a small table in front of him. He sighed.
I see. And all I have to do is leave.
Yes. Come with us.
What happens after that?
The High Priests will be kidnapped by an Imperial Commando squad brought in by a humanist-controlled aircraft. The Citadel here will be taken over by the troops outside. There are raids planned on the field HQs. They should be pretty bloodless. If necessary, the Hegemonarchy planes, tanks, artillery pieces and trucks will be put out of action, should the armed forces ignore the call put out by the High Priesthood to surrender their arms. Once they've seen a few planes and tanks laser-blasted from space, it's expected the fight will go out of the army.
Smar stopped pacing, came to stand in front of him, on the far side of the little table.
It all happens at dawn tomorrow.
It should be fairly bloodless, really, Zakalvi. You might as well leave now. It would be best.
He heard her exhale.
You've done brilliantly, Sheradinin. It's worked. You did it. Brought Beishai out. Got him. Motivated or whatever. We're grateful. We're very grateful. And it's not easy, he raised one hand to stop her.
He heard her sigh. He looked up from the small table, up to her face.
I can't leave right away. There are a few things I have to do.
I'd rather you left now and then came back. Pick me up tomorrow at dawn.
He shook his head. I won't desert them until then.
Smar opened her mouth, then closed it, glanced at the drone.
All right. We'll be back tomorrow, Zakalvi.
It's all right, Dizier, he interrupted calmly, and slowly stood up. He looked into her eyes.
She had to look away.
It'll be as you say.
Goodbye.
He didn't hold out his hand. Smar walked to the door. The drone followed her. The woman looked back. He nodded once. She hesitated, seemed to think the better of saying anything, and went out. The drone stopped there too.
Zakalvi, it said, I just want to add,
out, he screamed, and in one movement turned, swooped, caught the small table between the legs and threw it with all his might at the floating machine. The table bounced off an invisible field and clattered to the floor. The drone swept out and the door closed. He stood staring at it for some time.